Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, today, the big news of the overruling of Roe v. Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court, eliminating the constitutional right to abortion after almost 50 years. In the coming days, weeks, and months, we'll see how it transforms American life, reshapes our nation's politics. Now, the high court decision today allows states to decide how much they want to restrict abortion, and we can see that it will lead to all but total bans on the procedure in about half the states. What about Iowa? Let's get some early indications about that from our IPR state government reporter, Katarina Sestarik. Hello, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Start by giving us some background and on this moment that has been expected for weeks. What can you tell us off the bat what this means for abortion access in our state?
Well, abortion is still legal in Iowa, even with this court decision and the Iowa Supreme Court decision from last week. It's still legal up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. There may be a 24-hour abortion waiting period that will be enforced next month, potentially. But right now, that's kind of the current, that's still in place for Iowa. And so now it just kind of remains to be seen if the Iowa legislature is going to hold a special session to further restrict abortion. And until that happens, Iowa's 20-week abortion law will remain in place.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about that possible special session, whether they address it in a special session this year, the next regular session would be, of course, early next year. Do we know anything about that sessions, the Republicans' likely agenda in this new abortion setting across the country?
I don't know anything specific. You know, of course, I and other reporters have been asking Governor Kim Reynolds, as well as the Republican leaders of the Iowa House and Senate for the past several weeks, what their plans would be if this were to happen. And they have not given any specifics. They haven't said if they would call a special session. They haven't directly answered questions about whether if they pass more abortion restrictions, would there be, you know, exceptions for certain medical situations or other things like incest and rape. They haven't said, you know, what kind of abortion laws they want to pass. I mean, there are definitely some clues. They all say that they want to keep working to, you know, they say to protect the unborn. They want to restrict abortion more. They have previously passed abortion restrictions. Back in 2018, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill into law that banned abortions as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. That never went into effect because of the previous court rulings that were in place. But now that those are gone, you know, we're expecting to see them do something similar, potentially go even further. There's still just a lot up in the air.
Right. And I've been watching here in the hours after this breaking news. New York Times has a map of the United States, actually three maps, one showing states where the abortions will be prohibited or because of trigger laws already are prohibited or restricted. In the Midwest, that includes adjoining Iowa, South Dakota, also Missouri, but North Dakota as well, the southern states, off to the west, many states. Iowa, as you just alluded to, in that sort of uncertain category, Iowa, in a handful of states where it's uncertain where it will go, and then we have legal states where it is looks like it will stay legal, certainly in some states, New York, California, Washington, and Oregon, Illinois, and Minnesota, looking to be in that category here in the Midwest. What else can you tell us about abortion access in our immediate Midwestern area?
Right. Well, as you just mentioned, Missouri, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, abortions have been stopped there now is what I've been seeing. And so Nebraska is also, there's some uncertainty there. But right now in Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Illinois, there's still abortions are continuing. And, you know, I think I've heard from sources who work in the abortion care space that they have already seen a lot of people coming into Iowa from out of state, even just with the ripple effects of the restrictive abortion laws that were passed in Texas. And so people have already been pushed into Iowa, and Iowans have actually been pushed out of Iowa into other states to get abortions because people from other states have been taking up the appointments here. So that's probably just going to continue at an even greater scale for now.
Mm-hmm. You've been monitoring reactions from leaders in Iowa, elected officials, as well as those of abortion rights opponents, abortion rights advocates. What can you tell us about the early reaction?
Well, the governor and other Republican leaders are saying, you know, that this is a victory and one of the Supreme Court's greatest moments. But they say that, you know, they're going to keep working to restrict abortion in the state. Again, they haven't said what that will entail. The executive director of one of the main anti-abortion groups in the state said that she wants to keep working to pass a constitutional amendment in Iowa that would say the Iowa Constitution doesn't protect abortion rights. And she also wants to pass legislation to eliminate abortion. And then we have, you know, the Democratic leaders in the state saying that this is a dark day for freedom and that they want to keep fighting for every Iowan's right to decide when they want to have a family. They're saying, you know, they're encouraging people to vote for Democrats if they're people who support abortion rights, because Republicans are, you know, every indication is that they are going to restrict abortion. And from Planned Parenthood, you know, they're obviously condemning this decision, but they're saying that their doors are still open in Iowa and they'll keep providing abortion services where it remains legal.
Yeah. I'll just add to that this statement from Iowa's only Democratic member of our congressional delegation to Washington late this morning, issued by Representative Cindy Axney of Iowa's 3rd District. Part of her statement, today, she writes, is a tragic day for women and for all Americans. The Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade is unconscionable, cruel, and takes the power away from tens of millions of American women to make their own medical decisions. Part of the statement issued by Congresswoman Cindy Axney of Iowa's 3rd District. What else have you been gathering there? Will be, you know, for the next days and weeks, this will be really the topic. Be a lot of developments. Katerina, what else will you be watching or have you been monitoring?
Yeah, so abortion rights supporters, there are different groups that have told me that they have been working together with groups from all different states since the Roe decision was leaked an initial draft of that was leaked in May, that they are just coordinating to, you know, no matter what happens with abortion laws in the Midwest and the country as a whole, to make sure that people can get abortions if they want them. So that includes, you know, coordinating different funding and services to help people travel to other places. There's even, I've heard, a group of pilots that is volunteering to fly people to different states for abortion appointments. There's a group in Iowa that sprung up in recent weeks that says that they are delivering abortion pills to people for free, which, you know, that carries legal risk if people want to take that route, according to law experts, but that appears to be an option now in Iowa as well. And Iowa still has telemedicine abortion as well, where people can have telemedicine appointments, get an ultrasound, and take abortion pills in their own home. That version of it is legal. So there are still a lot of options for people who want an abortion in the state for now. And there's definitely just a lot of people who are working to try to preserve access to abortion, no matter what happens for Iowans. And then, you know, on the other side of people who want abortion to be completely illegal, they're going to be working with lawmakers, the Republican-led legislature, and with voters trying to get them to pass abortion bans. You know, and again, it's not clear what that's going to look like in Iowa. There's still some uncertainty with state-level constitutional protections, but it's looking pretty certain there will be some kind of abortion restrictions in the state.
Okay. IPR state government reporter Katarina Sestarek, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you're aboard for our quick conversations to end this news week here at IPR. Well, yesterday evening, let's go to this news just a few hours old. Yesterday evening in Washington, our two Republican U.S. Senators, Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley, they found themselves on opposite sides of a vote on a bipartisan gun safety bill. Grassley voting against the measure. Joni Ernst voting in favor. Ernst was one of 15 Republican senators to vote in favor of the proposal, joining all 50 Democrats. So that measure passed 65 to 33 in the Senate. Here to sort it out, Kathy Obradovich, editor-in-chief of Iowa Capital Dispatch. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Ben. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Glad it's arrived. This is a bill which still must pass the U.S. House before it would reach the president's desk. But also, if it does, it will be the first major piece of gun safety legislation to pass Congress in years. Of course, we've been reporting on this bipartisan group of senators negotiating a proposal in response to the recent mass shootings, especially in Buffalo and Uvalde, Texas. This is unusual, isn't it, to two Republican senators splitting on a vote like this?
Yeah, it's unusual in several ways. First of all, it's unusual for Senator Joni Ernst and Senator Chuck Grassley to be on opposite sides of an issue. It's also unusual in that there were only a few states where Republican senators split their votes. And it's also, Joni Ernst is in a pretty small group. The other, you said 15 Republicans voted for this. Well, 10 of them were on the bipartisan committee that actually wrote this law. So she is among a very small group of senators who weren't even part of the negotiation.
Yeah, releasing a quote, the Ernst campaign, the Ernst office said, "This bill does not take away the rights of any law-abiding American. Every American wants to keep our kids and our schools safe and provide folks to access to mental health treatment. And this proposal helps to do that without placing new restrictions on law-abiding gun owners." So fill us in. What are your thoughts on why Joni Ernst, as you pointed out, this very small group of GOP senators, not part of the negotiating team, jumped into the yay votes?
So I can only speculate beyond what she's actually said. But, you know, there are some things in her background and her past positions on issues that might give us a little bit of a clue. For example, she has not been a hard line against absolutely no restrictions on gun ownership. She's been on the record as saying people should have to be 21 in order to buy assault weapons, for example. She's a combat veteran. She knows what these weapons are all about. She's been trained to use them. She's a gun owner herself. And she also, this legislation also had stronger language to try to protect victims of domestic violence. And they call it the boyfriend loophole, trying to address some of the fact that, you know, not everybody who might be subject to domestic violence is, you know, married to their partner, for example. So and she's been very open about the fact that she's been a victim of domestic violence as well. So it's entirely possible that that is a, you know, an issue that she feels strongly enough about to cross party lines in this way.
Yeah. Also notable that if we think back to her first campaign in which she became U.S. Senator eventually, we had several famous ads, notable ads. One was, of course, the Make 'em Squeal pig ad. But the other one that I remember was, I'm picturing her in the ad getting on a motorcycle, driving to a gun range and shooting a gun. So really interesting.
Yeah, she's absolutely been a strong supporter. She gets support from the NRA, as does Senator Grassley. She is describing this bill as something that does not restrict the rights of law-abiding Americans. So that, is an interesting point. Whether she'll face any fallout for that vote from NRA in the future or Republicans who, Iowa Republicans in the legislature over the past few years have been steadily strengthening gun rights and rolling back gun control, restrictions in Iowa legislature. So it'll be interesting to see how people treat that when she's next up for reelection. On the other hand, Chuck Grassley, he's the one who's up for reelection this year.
Yeah, and so let's talk about that in a moment, but I wanted to outline, you mentioned the closing the so-called boyfriend loophole there, but quickly the other aspects of this, what Democrats would say be a very modest gun safety bill, expanding background checks on gun buyers 21 years old and younger, including the mental health and juvenile justice records, providing a 10-day waiting period to complete that review, expanding gun sellers who must conduct a background checks. Also, interestingly, money to states to enact so-called red flag laws, boosting mental health resources, making some safety improvements at schools, some of the other aspects here. Let's talk more about Senator Grassley. He faces the Democrat, Mike Franken, in his bid for reelection this year. How do you think that this vote might figure into that campaign?
It'll be interesting to see. I think that Democrats and Republicans tend to be fairly entrenched on issues like guns, although, when you see somebody like Senator Joni Ernst crossing the aisle, that might have an effect. I think the question is, where the independents will, how they will break on this particular bill. Grassley sort of indicated in his statement that there were aspects of the legislation that he would have supported, but he particularly, we talked a little bit about that boyfriend loophole, he particularly zeroed in on that and said it was written in, the language was too vague, that it would be up to the courts to determine who's subject to the law. His statement last night said, it turned me against the legislation when I heard my colleagues say that the courts would have to sort out what the bill means, which, happens a lot with a lot of legislation that Congress passes. But, ultimately, he said, the ambiguity needed to be clarified, but there was no mechanism to do that during the process of the debate. So that was his reason.
Yeah, and we remember earlier this week in the procedural vote to bring this to the floor, he voted also no. Joni Ernst was also a yes, and he was. Then his complaint was, this is a 80-page bill, and I have to review it. It was delivered very, very close to that procedural vote.
Yeah, and I think that might have been a legitimate complaint. And when I heard him say that, I thought maybe he was leaving himself an opening to change his mind and actually vote for the bill. But ultimately, most of the time, if a senator votes against cloture, which is the procedural vote to let a bill come to the floor, they're probably going to be a no on the bill as well.
Yeah. Okay. So now it goes to the House. The Democrats holding a slim majority in the U.S. House. Our House members, three of four of them are Republicans. Axne, the only House member who's a Democrat from Iowa. The Republicans, Hinson, Miller Meeks, and Feenstra. Your thoughts there on any incentive for the Iowa Republicans in this group to support this bill in the House?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Ben, this vote is happening today, so it may happen before we're on the air. So just FYI. But I will just say Iowa Republicans have been pretty strongly against gun restrictions, and Cindy Axne has indicated she's for them. I think that it's safe to say that this measure is set to pass the House. It won't get as much Republican support percentage-wise probably as it did in the Senate. President Biden has already indicated last night or this morning that he's eager to sign the bill.
Right. Yeah. And just to remind our listeners, in case you're listening to this, and we do have that breaking news, Kathy and I are talking at about 9 o'clock on Friday morning. So we have a fast moving news environment. And I'm glad you pointed that out, Kathy.
You gotta love that on a Friday, don't you?
You gotta love that adrenaline rush on a Friday to kick us into the weekend. So we have ever more reason to relax. Kathy Obradovich, we love your reporting and your insights. Editor-in-Chief of Iowa Capital Dispatch. Kathy, thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. You have a good weekend too, Ben. I appreciate it.
Friday News Buzz on this momentous news day. The breaking news, of course, absorbing that from the Supreme Court. In the rest of our show, we'll tackle other news apart from that Supreme Court news. Natalie Krebs, IPR health reporter, updating us on COVID vaccinations. Clay Masters has been out in D.C. this week at a DNC meeting. He'll talk about the future of Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses. And toward the end of the program, we groove into the weekend with Tony Daner. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations we like to have to end the news week. That's what News Buzz is about, often with journalists here in Iowa. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with IPR's Clay Masters. He's been in Washington, D.C. this week at a DNC meeting. I'll talk with him about the future of Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses. And at the very end, of course, we'll groove into the weekend. Tony Daner will join me to do that. But first, a few days ago, we heard the Federal officials had authorized the use of the Pfizer, also the Moderna vaccinations, in younger folks, children ages 6 months to 4 years. Let's check in and get some details from Natalie Krebs, IPR's health reporter. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Ben.
Give us some details on this new authorization.
Yeah, so federal officials late last week authorized both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine. The Moderna vaccine was authorized for kids aged 6 months to 5 years old in a two-dose series given 4 weeks apart, and then the Pfizer vaccine for kids 6 months to 4 years in a three-dose series given over 14 weeks or maybe even a little bit longer. The timeline kind of varies on those. Basically, you know, lowering the age of kids who can get the vaccine. It used to be 5 years. Now it's down to 6 months. So just offering, again, more protection for younger children.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of grateful parents have already sought out those vaccinations or made the appointments. You sought out a specialist at the Blank Children's Hospital there in Des Moines. What did you learn from him?
Yeah, I spoke to Joel Waddell. He's a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, just to learn some details about this vaccine, basically, and to see what he had to say, as I'm sure a lot of parents have questions about this. He basically said, you know, he really encourages parents to get their young children vaccinated. Still really unlikely that young kids will get really sick from COVID, but we have seen young kids get sick from COVID. And he pointed out too, the CDC recently said COVID-19 is the fifth leading cause of death for young children, that like infant toddler range. So basically there is that chance. And what Dr. Waddell basically said, he's, you know, at times seen kids who have no underlying conditions get really sick from COVID. So it's not really quite clear what causes kids to get really sick. He also pointed out we don't know really the long-term effects that the virus could have on the body.
Yeah, and just like adults, these young kids need those antibodies to give them a better chance at fending this off, as you said. And we have to emphasize, don't we, here, Natalie, that, you know, a vaccine doesn't mean it's not possible you won't get symptoms or severe symptoms or, God forbid, worse. It's all about preventing symptoms, raising antibodies, trying to prevent the most severe outcomes, right?
Right. Really, what health experts say is those vaccines are good against preventing severe illness and hospitalizations, which is really the goal. You could still have some mild symptoms of COVID, but really not those severe symptoms.
Yeah. I'm happy I got my second booster just last week. So my immunity is hopefully maxed out, and I hope our listeners are doing the same. And now we can have the children there right along getting their immunity, fighting this pandemic virus. Hey, how soon, when you talked to that specialist at Blank Children's Hospital in hospital, did he say how soon after the vaccination, the immunity of the little ones ramps up?
It's like the same for adults. So basically you want to get that whole shot series. And then I think about 2 weeks to a month afterwards is when you reach full immunity. So he's really encouraged parents to get the shot as soon as they can. And, you know, as it rolls out, it's been kind of slow for some parents to get appointments. But just as soon as you can get that appointment, just because experts say they're expecting COVID-19 cases to increase in fall, winter. So basically making sure your young kid has that protection by the time we reach fall is really important.
Yeah. So many misconceptions about the vaccinations still out there preventing people from getting vaccinated themselves or their kids vaccinated. You addressed this straight on with that specialist, didn't you?
Yeah, I just asked him, you know, looking at state data, the states, only about a quarter of the state's 5 to 11-year-olds have been fully vaccinated. You know, I asked Dr. Waddell a little bit about what he's hearing from parents. Like he said, just those general concerns about fertility issues in kids and then also just long-term effects of the vaccine. He basically said, you know, there's been no scientific evidence that this COVID-19 vaccine causes fertility issues. That's been widely reported. And then also on the other side of that, basically this concern about long-term effects of the vaccine. He basically said what I've heard other experts say, which is all of the authorized vaccines we have out there right now for anything, we've never seen these long-term side effects. You know, we haven't seen any side effects pop up months or years after, you know, kids get a vaccine. So he said he was basically a lot more concerned about kids getting COVID, basically, than kids getting vaccinated against COVID.
Mm-hmm. And good advice. You don't have to take it from you or from the doctor you're quoting there. If any parent listening has any questions, what do they do?
Yeah, and at the end of it, just Dr. Waddell really encouraged parents to go talk to your pediatrician. Parents surely have questions about this new vaccine for young kids. So, you know, you're going to want to talk to your kid's pediatrician just to see what shot is right for them, what to expect, and then their own, you know, individual condition, whether they've had COVID recently and what really works best for your kid.
Okay, Natalie Krebs, thanks for that update. Health reporter for Iowa Public Radio. Take care, Natalie.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for years, the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, has allowed Iowa to be the first, along with New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, the lead states in the presidential nominating contests every 4 years. Now, that traditional lead position for Iowa, we've heard that in the news, it goes way back to the 1970s, is now very much in question for the Democrats. The past couple of days in Washington, D.C., officials from 17 states, including Iowa, have made formal presentations to the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee. IPR's Clay Masters has been out in D.C. covering this event, this Democrats' final pitch to stay first in the nation. I spoke with him earlier today while he was at the airport gate in Washington, just about to fly back to Iowa. Hello, Clay Masters.
Hey, Ben. How's it going?
Going well. Let's have a little conversation before you hop on the plane. Tell us more about what's been happening in the past couple of days and why it's been happening.
So there's been a lot of buildup up to this week, and that is because the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee, which is a committee within a committee, they've set the calendar for the presidential nominating contest. They've been meeting virtually, some in person, to talk about changing up the early window. Of course, there was some fuel thrown on that fire. There's been a panning of the caucuses going on for many, many years because they're not as inclusive as a straight primary election. And after 2020, there was an appetite to change things up. So here in Washington, these states, 16 states, as well as Puerto Rico, have come forward. They've made their formal presentations. Some people brought high-profile politicians from their state. Others had slick videos. New Hampshire sent out some goodie bags to the members with maple syrup in it, and they've all made their case. And now we're just going to kind of wait to see what happens next.
Right. So they've all been making their cases. Is it clear to the states out there what the criteria they are being measured by? What is the committee using to judge the states?
So some of the criteria are they're preferring primaries over caucuses. Remember, these are different things. They're also preferring asking states to talk about their diversity with a population that looks more like the rest of the country and isn't as overwhelmingly white like a state like Iowa. They're also wanting the states to talk about their competitiveness in general elections, which is another thing that's kind of been going against Iowa. If you just look at general elections and presidential years over the last, you know, since 2016, when Donald Trump won Iowa so handily. And they're also interested in other aspects like feasibility, you know, media markets and the cost for candidates to run in those states. So those are kind of some of the criteria in each of the states that got up and talked. We're trying to say, hey, we're the best for that.
Yeah. Several Iowa Democratic Party leaders are out there making that case. Give us a sense of what these Iowa Democratic leaders pitched out there to sway the committee.
Well, the biggest thing that they brought forward are these fundamental changes that they've proposed to the Iowa Democratic Party's caucuses. And if you remember, this was announced earlier this month that they're saying we're going to give Democratic caucus goers 14 to 28 days to basically fill out a presidential preference card. And then you either mail that in or drop it off. And so that changes caucus night a lot. I mean, people that have gone to a Democratic caucus might remember there's a lot of, you know, moving around a gymnasium or a cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And that's going to go away if these go forward. And it's probably going to change no matter what this committee from the DNC decides. And so that was kind of the big thing that the Iowa Democratic Party chair Ross Wilburn was stressing when it was Iowa's chance to come forward, was they're saying, hey, we're prepared to make fundamental changes to the Iowa caucuses in order to keep it in the early window. And they're saying first.
Yeah. Wow. What you're saying is some really big moments in past Iowa political history. And we have covered some of those moments. I'm thinking back to the election, the surprise win in the caucuses by Barack Obama. So that scene, that spectacle, that surprise win would not be something that would be replayed in another form in the future. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, you're highlighting the alignments that, you know, if your candidate's not viable, you have to choose somebody else. And as you mentioned, 2008 was when Hillary Clinton was largely seen as the front runner. And then overwhelmingly, people, when their candidate wasn't viable, went to Barack Obama. And that's what propelled him to secure the presidential nomination in 2008. I mean, he was back in Iowa in 2012 before that general election saying, hey, it all started here. People might remember the podcast we did, Caucus Land, where there mm-hmm. were those scenes from 2012. And that would go away. The Iowa Democratic Party, though, is saying, you know, this is an opportunity for people who have not been able to participate in past caucuses to participate now. So those that are single parents and can't secure childcare on a Monday night, or, you know, people that worked second shift or military personnel, this is a chance to open up the window and make more voices within Iowa be heard during the caucuses. So that's what they were proposing. And there were a lot of questions about how that would work.
Yeah, I wonder about those questions specifically when caucus goers would request this presidential preference card, have to return it in some amount of days, mail it back, return it in person. How was the response or reaction to that?
Well, there were a lot of questions. I mean, they got credit from the RBC members, especially from some of their sharpest critics. Were kind of saying, you know, hey, this is innovative, this is new, this is different. But there was another member who was asking, you know, this sounds a lot like a primary election. And traditionally, New Hampshire has, you know, balked at that. If Iowa starts to smell too much like a primary, they say, our state law says that we are the first primary election to go. And so the Scott Brennan, the Iowa Democratic Party chair for a few years, who also serves on this Rules and Bylaws Committee, I was talking about, well, we have to have a caucus because we have a state law, just like New Hampshire has a state law that says that it has to have the first primary. And this is a caucus by our, you know, we think that this meets that code.
Yeah, right. Over the years, going back, you know, some 50 years, the Democratic caucuses have coexisted every 4 years alongside the GOP, the Republican nominating events here in Iowa. Describe the larger context in which this Democratic debate in the DNC is taking place. The Democrats, the Republicans, not having this same dilemma, are they?
No, they're not. They're moving forward with the status quo calendar of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. In fact, Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman serves on the kind of counterpart committee to the one that I've been covering this week for the Democrats. And, you know, he's really proud that they're moving forward with the current calendar. And, you know, I've already been covering potential presidential candidates on the Republican side who have been, you know, testing the waters in Iowa. And the Republican Party caucus is much different than the Democratic Party's caucus for the last, you know, decades, in that they are filling out a little piece of paper, they're putting it in a hat, and then they're, you know, at the end of the night drawing who the winner is. And so the Iowa Democratic Party is saying, you know, this is different than the past, but the Republican and the Democratic caucuses have been very different over the years as well. And I should point out, too, that the Republican parties in these states that also tried out, they're going to be powerful in the fact that if they want to change and move along with their Democratic counterparts, you know, that's going to cause some problems within the Republican National Committee where these decisions have already been set. But if there are Democrats in maybe Minnesota or Michigan running for president, Republicans are going to want to get on that, too. So it's really a can of worms that's been opened with trying to figure out how to move forward.
Clay Masters at Reagan Airport in Washington, IPR's lead political reporter. He's been there a couple of days. Clay, I'm picturing you there in a fairly quiet corner at the gate at Reagan Airport. Have you had your coffee yet this morning?
I haven't, but a funny anecdote real quick, as I was sitting down to talk to you just now, Senator Bernie Sanders, who has done really well in a couple of Iowa caucuses, walked past me. So just kind of humorous to see that right before I get on the air to talk to you.
Well, maybe catch up with him and get an extra interview.
There you go.
All right. Have a safe trip back to Iowa. Thank you for this conversation. Clay Masters.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Well, we've come to the end of your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer now with Tony Daner of IPR Studio One on this 24th day of June, just after the summer solstice. Tony Daner, if I've ever met a sunny personality, it is yours. It's just a solstice reference. Did I succeed? I don't know. Kind of a dad joke there, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, one dad to another. Yeah, great joke there, but I've never been called Sunny before. That's a new one.
Okay. Groove us into the weekend, Tony. What do you have?
Let's start off with this is kind of a seemingly unlikely combination, but it really works. Winona and Waxahachie. This is the Winona Judd with her first new music in about 2 years, teaming up with Katie Crutchfield, the voice of the indie rock project Waxahachie, which has some obvious country and roots influences. Katie Crutchfield grew up near Waxahachie Creek in Alabama. She's been a fan of Winona Judd's for a long time, and I'm not sure how they made a connection, but they did, and they recorded this song on Winona's farmland near Nashville. Winona here, for her part, is fulfilling a pledge to keep putting out music since the tragic and untimely passing of her mother, Naomi. And for Katie Crutchfield, she calls this one of her favorite recording experiences ever. This is Winona and Waxahachie with Other Side.
Take my word, I got a wild head. I'm standing as still as I can. Say my piece like an offhand. I'm living in a grain of sand. I'm coming in hard. There my torch. You once carried readily, but you say my name like it's your favorite song. A breeze blowing against my lips. I got a heart, heart of gold. Cast a shadow. If we move our way against the tide, there's something on the other side. The other side.
Tony Daner, those voices mesh so well. Nice selection. Remind us of the artist again.
So Winona and Waxahachie, spelled kind of like it sounds, Waxahachie.
Okay, The Other Side is the title of that tune. We have time for one more. Tony, what do you have?
Okay, an artist who just put out his second album and I think is getting ready to take the leap into kind of indie rock stardom. His name is Bartiz Strange. His second record is called Farm to Table, just came out last week. Bartiz Strange kind of takes the great delight in making music that's very hard to categorize. He's got punk, indie, hip-hop, country sounds on this record. And his background, Ben, is as varied as his musical influences. His father was career military. His mother was a gospel singer. Bartiz went to opera camp as a kid, studied journalism in college, and at one point was a deputy press secretary for the FCC, of all places. And which is funny because there are a few non-FCC-friendly songs on this new record, but this is not one of them, and I'm really excited to play it. This is Bartiz Strange with Wretched.
I can't be here lost and abandoned. Nobody asked me. I cannot stand by. And every day I toss and turn.
Wow, Tony, I was bracing after that windup you had for this new artist. I was bracing myself, but I like it a lot. I'm glad you selected it. Artis Strange. Am I getting that right? That's the artist here.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, it's a great song, and I haven't really had a chance to listen to the whole record yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, we'll go out with more of Artis. Wish you well on this weekend. Tony, thank you for grooving us into the weekend. We wish you well. Remind us quickly how IPR listeners can make sure they get your daily soundtrack and tune into All Access.
Yeah, Studio One Tracks, 6 nights a week, Monday through Saturday at 7 o'clock. Studio One All Access, Saturday at 1 o'clock, Sunday night at 7. And you can check us out on the web, iprstudio1.org.
Okay, thanks, Tony. Take care.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
River to River today, produced by Zachary Oren-Smith, Samantha McIntosh, and our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. Podcasting on-demand audio as well of River to River, available through our IPR app or by going to iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talk to you again next week. Take care.